Okay, welcome to part two of our continuing series of Jewish medical ethics. Last week we had the opportunity to talk about some historical aspects dealing with issues of anatomical dissection and mummies and illustrating how the rabbis of previous generations have indeed addressed medical halachic issues and will continue to do so, Mirza Shem, into the future. Today we're talking about an extremely current and very exciting topic, and as you well know, just to give you an idea of how important this topic is, the field of organ transplantation, there have been three international conferences over the past year on the topic of organ donation and transplantation. There has been one in Israel, two in the United States, for a total of about 6 or 7 days. And as you in Toronto also well know, there is a conference scheduled for this coming Sunday on the topic of organ transplantation. We are tonight going to be discussing some of those issues. I also encourage you, for those of you who attend the conference on Sunday, if you have any issues or questions or clarifications from that conference on Sunday, that you want me to address next week, I would be delighted to do so. As coincidence would have it, and Rabbi Kelman knows, I will actually be in Toronto on Sunday, but very unfortunately will not be able to participate in that conference. I will actually be at York University that day. But I encourage you to attend the conference on organ donation. I'm sure it will be a wonderful and educational conference. So just to set the stage for this evening's conference, for this evening's discussion, two other brief preparatory notes. One is this week's New England Journal from dated today, March 8th, 2007. One of their big editorials is on the topic of organ donation. Aspects of this we probably won't address significantly tonight. But just to give you an idea of how current this topic is, the title of the article in this in today's New England Journal is "Ethical Challenges Posed by the Solicitation of Deceased and Living Organ Donors." And what this article deals with, and I'm not so sure how much you get this in Canada, and feel free to raise these issues to my attention, but in the United States, there have been a number of cases of individuals desiring organs that weren't able to obtain them through the normal means and tried some extraordinary means to obtain organs. And that has included, for example, putting advertisements on billboards across highways. That's included television shows or segments on the news. And that has raised awareness of these particular individuals' plight, and in certain cases, these individuals have received organs, but they would not have been first on the list for receiving organs, and there has been extensive debate in the ethics and transplantation community about the propriety of people utilizing these means to obtain organs. So you see what an issue it is, and a continuing issue of great interest to the general ethical and medical community. And the other thing I did just a few moments before going on the air with you this evening is to check some statistics. In the United States, there is a national organization called the United Network of Organ Sharing, which keeps statistics of all those who are awaiting transplants. I'm not sure if there's an analogous organization in Canada. But as of about 8:30 this evening, actually 8:50 I think was the last time that I checked, there are 95,350 people in the United States that are awaiting organs on the recipient list. And that list is largely comprised of those awaiting kidneys. Kidney donation is one aspect we'll talk about quite a bit this evening, but if you were to break down the list, probably 70 to 80% of those on the list are awaiting kidneys. The others are awaiting hearts, livers, lungs, pancreas, and a few other organs. Our discussion this evening will be divided into two sections. We're going to discuss both living organ donation, which will be the first section of our discussion, and the latter half of our discussion this evening we will be discussing cadaveric donation, or donation from a deceased. The name has actually changed over the years. It used to be called cadaveric donation. Now it's called deceased donation, and there have been a number of reasons for that as well. So to begin our first section, we'll talk about the living organ donation. First of all, I'd like to address which organs today in 2007 are currently being transplanted from one living human being to another living human being. And those include, from the most basic to the more complex, blood, for example, is the largest organ in the body, and blood has been transplanted from one human being to another for many, many years. More recently, bone marrow donation is another organ which has been transplanted. Kidneys have been transplanted since the 1960s. And of late, the last decade, there have been two other organs which have been added to the list of living organ transplantation. And those are lungs. One could transplant a lobe of a lung. And the other one is liver. A lobe of a liver can be transplanted from one human being to another. So to introduce our section on living transplantation, I'd like to share with you the following case, which is a real case which occurred about 6 or 7 years ago. And that's the case of a young girl whose name is Renata Patterson. This young girl, a teenager, lived in the middle of the United States, and her parents had actually become estranged from one another. And her husband, the father, actually landed himself in jail, as the circumstance was. And this young girl developed kidney failure at a very young age, 11 or 12 years old. And her father heard that that his daughter developed kidney failure, and he kindly offered to serve as a kidney donor for his daughter. And indeed, this was the case. He was from prison. Of course, so there are other issues about our tax dollars paying for these donations from this man in prison. But be that as it may, he served as a kidney donor for his daughter. But what subsequently happened is the following. An important fact in our halakhic discussions of organ transplantation is that when someone receives an organ, generally their body would naturally reject such an organ. And in fact, today in the emergency department, I worked this afternoon, I saw an individual who was in the process of rejecting a kidney that he had received. Montefiore, where I work, is a major kidney transplant center, and we see patients on a daily basis who have complications from their transplants. But in order to prevent somebody from rejecting the transplant, there has developed a type of medicine called immunosuppressive medicines. These medicines, as the name implies, suppress your immune system and prevent your body from rejecting the organ. And of course, there are some side effects of these medications. If you take these medicines, it not only prevents you from rejecting the organ, it also prevents you from rejecting any infections that you may have. So if an organ transplant patient tests something as minor as a cold or a fever of 101, 102, whereas the average person would take some Tylenol and sleep it off, transplant person has to come to the emergency room to make sure everything is okay because they're taking medicines to suppress their immune system. So this young girl was a teenager, and until this point she had been on dialysis, and now she received a kidney transplant, and it was her first lease on life as an adolescent, as a teenager. So as you can well imagine, she neglected to take her medicines. So what invariably happened is she rejected the kidney which her father donated to her. What then happened is the father made the following offer. He said, allow me to donate my second kidney to my daughter, and I will go on dialysis. And I would prefer that I go on dialysis rather than have my daughter go back on dialysis. So the question that I would like to entertain this evening is, first of all, is it halakhically appropriate for Mr. Patterson to have donated his first kidney? And secondly, our follow-up question, is it halakhically appropriate for Mr. Patterson to donate his second kidney? Is that something that halacha would entertain? So to begin, I turn your attention to the first page of the handout to begin our source analysis. What would compel us as Jews to serve as an organ donor to begin with? So the source of our donation, of our Jewish faith's encouraging donation, stems from just a few words in the Bible from Vayikra, on the very top of your handout. Lo sa'amod al dam re'echa. Do not stand idly by as the blood of your brother is being shed, which means if somebody's life is at risk, we have an obligation to intervene, to do the best you possibly can to save that individual. But how is this obligation manifest? So the Talmud discusses the practical application of this biblical dictate, Lo Samar Adam Re'acha. And the next passage, which appears in the Talmud of Sanhedrin, reads, Gufo minayim l'roa es chavero shu tovea banohar, o chaya gororoso, o listim boina lo, shu chayv hatzilo. How do we know, the Talmud asks, that if somebody is drowning, or if someone is being attacked by a band of marauders, or being attacked by a wild animal, that we should intervene? Perhaps we should do nothing, or we have no obligation. So the Talmud teaches us that we have this right. But the Talmud then adds that we have another phrase that establishes our obligation to save a human life, and that phrase is v'hashev osolo, which is the phrase of restoring lost objects. And the Talmud says, well, what is the greatest object that one would always want to be restored to him or her? And that's one's health or one's life. So surely the obligation to save a life is subsumed under this obligation of Hashiv Osolo, restoring lost objects. But the Talmud then continues and says, no, that's not the case. It's actually not exclusively from v'hashev osolo, because the obligation of v'hashev osolo only entails a bodily obligation, an obligation to physically return an object if at all possible, but it's a very limited obligation. So, for example, if you see something in the street that belongs to somebody, a watch, a pen, whatever it may be, you have an obligation to advertise it. Nowadays, you can put an email out. So, for example, there was somebody who lost their tefillin in JFK, about a year ago, and someone put out a mass email, probably hit the entire world within a day, that it was unmarked tefillin, which was found in JFK Airport, and somebody, and actually the tefillin was ultimately restored to its proper owner. But do you have to take out an ad in the New York Times on the front page, which would cost you, you know, a few thousand dollars? And the answer is no. You're not halakhically obligated to spend any money in restoring a lost object. So that's why the Talmud says to save a life, it's not only v'hashiv osolo, which is a bodily obligation, it also includes lo sa'amod al dam re'echa, which is a financial obligation. So there's a twofold obligation in this lo sa'amod al dam re'echa. And just parenthetically, testimony to the Jewish aspect of the state of Israel, which is quite extraordinary, in the United States, and I trust the same as in Canada as well, if there's an accident, someone doesn't have an obligation to stop and intervene. There are laws, perhaps, which would protect an individual if they do stop, the Good Samaritan laws, but for sure no obligation to stop. In Israel, there is a law on the books called the Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa law, which, according to this law, if an individual has an opportunity, an easy opportunity, to intervene and rescue somebody, and neglects to do so, one could incur a fine, a financial fine, if they refrain from saving another human life, which is, it's quite an extraordinary thing that a law like that exists. Obviously, it's a biblical law, but it finds its expression in modern-day Israel as well. So while this is helpful for us in our quest to determine our obligation in organ donation, that one has an obligation to physically save a life, and a financial obligation to save a life, there's one dimension which is missing. And if you look, we'll skip to the fourth line in the handout. The Shulchan Aruch codifies from the Gemara this obligation that we just mentioned. It says, Haroes chaveros aveabayam, which the language is borrowed clearly from the Gemara. If you see somebody drowning or being attacked by robbers, etc., etc., velohi tzil, skipping to the second line, over alosa amod al damariyacha, you have violated the obligation of losa amod al damariyacha. But one crucial aspect which is missing from this analysis, which is directly relevant to living organ donation, is how much risk the rescuer has to incur in order to save the life of somebody else. So we know there's a physical obligation if there's not that much risk. We know that there's a financial obligation, but we don't know how risky the procedure or the rescue can be for me to embark on such a rescue. And for this, to answer this question, we turn to a very famous source which is used to this very day in direct application to organ donation about analysis of risk in Lo Samar Al Dam Re'echa. And we turn to the source of Radbaz in the middle of your handout. Sha'alta mimani adiyacha da'ati oma ra'isa kosuv im omra shilta nisro hanachli litzot eiver echad she'in chomeis mimenu o amis yisro chavercha. So this is the question. Now, the assumption is that it's a hypothetical question, but it's tragically reminiscent of things in our collective memory over the past 60, 70 years. If you have two individuals standing side by side, and a soldier or a dictator says to one individual, allow me to amputate one of your limbs, and if you don't let me do so, I will kill the Jew standing next to you. Rahman will find a terrible circumstance. What is the obligation of that individual? Should he allow his limb to be amputated to save the life of somebody else? Or perhaps not. Perhaps he's forbidden to save the life of the individual because he has an obligation to preserve his own life. There is an obligation of Nishmartem Oda Nasha Seifen, and who says his blood is any redder than yours? So it is this aspect that the Radbaz addresses. How much risk you have to take to save the life of another person. So here we turn to his answer in the middle of this section. Tshuva zu midas chassidus. Says for an individual to embark on this kind of rescue of somebody else, to allow a limb, albeit an extremity and not a vital limb, to be amputated, is an extraordinary act of chesed, undoubtedly a laudatory act. However, he continues, the su, reading in the underlying section, the words of the Torah are the ways of Hashem, are the ways of pleasantness. And there has to be some aspect of it, for sure the major aspect of it, this is a somewhat debatable point, should be appealing in principle. That's Svara. The Eichya Leal Da'atenu, Shianiyach Odom Lesama Es Einav, Olachtoch Es Yodo Raglo, Kadesh Lo Yomisu Es Chavero. How could you envision a law, Rav David Ben Zimra says, that would absolutely require you to have a limb amputated, even if it means saving the life of somebody else? So he concludes that indeed you are not obligated to do so. And he divides it really into three categories. Category one is when the rescue, and this is summarized from next tshuva, and I'll just synopsize it outside, which a section of which appears on your handout in the next passage. If the rescue is extraordinarily risky, and for the sake of the simplicity, we'll assume that the risk is greater than 50% that you will die in the course of the rescue, as David Ben Zimra says, you are forbidden from engaging in such a rescue. And somebody who embarks on this rescue with high-risk stakes is considered a chassid shote, a pious fool. And is, according to most poskim, would be forbidden from doing such a thing. Conversely, if the rescue has very limited or minimal risk, then one is absolutely obligated under the rubric of Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa to embark on such a rescue. However, there is a huge gray area or chasm in the middle between the limited risk and the great risk, where an individual is neither obligated nor prohibited from embarking on the rescue, but has the option to do so if he or she so chooses. This is the category that he placed the question of allowing the individual to amputate a minor limb, say a finger or something like that, to preserve the life of another individual. He said one is absolutely not obligated to do so, one is not forbidden to do so, but one can exercise the option to do so, and if one does, he hastens to add, kol hakavod to you, it is an extraordinary act of kindness. So let us now take these principles of David ben Zimra and apply them to the contemporary circumstance of living organ donation. So let's approach it in a stepwise fashion, from the simplest form of living organ donation to the most complex form of organ donation. Let us take, for example, blood. Now, how risky is it to donate blood? I'm sure many of you have donated, had an opportunity to donate blood. Baruch Hashem, it's not a risky procedure at all. And in fact, unless you don't eat your Stoladora cookies right afterwards, you might faint. But it's not a risk to life to serve as a blood donor. So could one be compelled to serve as a blood donor? So imagine a scenario where you have a small town where there's one hospital, and in the operating room there's somebody who has the AB negative blood, and the surgeon nicks the aorta in the course of the operation, and blood starts spurting all over the operating room, and the person starts exsanguinating. And there's only one other person in the entire town with AB negative blood. Can you then, and they go to this person, and they knock on the door, I said, fine, listen, you got to give us blood right now. This person has AB negative blood. He's dying in the operating room. If you don't give us the blood, he's going to die right now. So Chaim says, I have some guests. Why don't you come back in an hour? We can talk about it. So according to Halacha, are you allowed to barge into Chaim's house, drag him to the hospital, tie him down, and draw blood from him? Are you obligated? Are you allowed to do such a thing? So in the eyes of American law, for example, there's no question you're not allowed to touch Chaim. He can do whatever he wants, even at the expense of the life of the individual sitting in the operating room. But according to the halacha, at least according to some poskim, you may indeed be able to force that person to donate blood, because he not only does he have an obligation of los amod al dam riecha, we as a community have an obligation to enforce his obligation of los amod al dam riecha. And therefore, according to some posting, yes, indeed, you could compel this person to donate blood because the risk to him is minimal and the advantage to the person in the operating room is truly life-saving. What about bone marrow donation? How risky is bone marrow donation? Now here, I would hasten to add, and I will probably mention this also, So Rabbi Kelman points out, what about the obligation to give blood stam? Clearly there is a collective community obligation for each of us to try and do what we can to save the lives of others, and something so easily done with such limited detriment to us is really an extraordinary mitzvah, there's no question about it. But it's interesting, there may not be a direct connection to a specific patient to compel you. But therein lies the difference between blood donation and bone marrow donation. And I'll get to that in a moment. In bone marrow donation, how risky is bone marrow donation? Now, as I was about to say, one of the exciting fields of Yirayat Chol Lefoneinu, Inachanami, one of the exciting things about this field is that things are continually evolving. For halacha to continually address these changes as they are evolving, and we need to reanalyze some issues that have been addressed in previous generations. So take, for example, the issue of bone marrow donation. Bone marrow donation a number of years ago was a more complicated procedure. One had to undergo general anesthesia for bone marrow donation. One had to harvest, literally bore large holes into the bone to harvest the marrow from multiple places. a higher likelihood of infection. Person was most definitely out of work for a fair amount of time. What is the risk in bone marrow donation today? In many cases, and not all, each case has to be analyzed from its medical perspective, one may not even be required to donate bone marrow at all. Now, and Mir Tosham will get to this in our later lectures, with the advent of stem cell research, one could even donate stem cells from their bloodstream. Every individual has literally a handful of stem cells in their bloodstream, which can be used to regenerate an entire blood system in another individual. So the risk to the individual is much, much less. And in contradistinction to blood, in bone marrow, there is a potential link of one individual to another individual. So you may not realize this, but when you donate, you'll see in many newspapers throughout the country, Jewish newspapers, invariably there are requests for donations, and I should have mentioned at the beginning, every single week in the Jewish press, there are at least two or three advertisements for people needing kidneys, people requiring kidneys. And you also see very frequently people who are in need of bone marrow donation. So when you sign up for these bone marrow drives, and they are marketed as a bone marrow drive for a particular individual who is in need, you don't sign up only for that individual. You go on a national or perhaps international registry. So it's quite possible that either next week, next year, or next decade, you will get a call from the bone marrow registry that says, Mr. Reichman, you are found to be a possible match to somebody who is in need of a bone marrow donation. So what's the halacha there? Are you halachically obligated to serve as a bone marrow donor to an individual? So here, while this is relatively new literature, until now the answer has been clearly an extraordinary opportunity to donate bone marrow, one which one should think long and hard before they pass up. It's very rare that any human being gets the opportunity to save somebody else's life or potentially save someone else's life with such little effort. But I heard Rabbi Willig say that one may be halachically obligated to serve as a bone marrow donor, and one could perhaps even compel somebody to serve as a bone marrow donor. So let's move up a notch to kidney donation. How risky is kidney donation? So kidney donation is a little more risky, and here, like all issues from the medical halacha perspective, you have to analyze all aspects of the donation. So here, uniquely, there are two elements of the donation, because in blood and bone marrow, those things regenerate. Your blood will regenerate. Your bone marrow will regenerate. But your kidney does not regenerate. So when you donate a kidney, there's not only the risk of the surgery itself, there is the risk of leaving the... Yes, Rabbi Mordechai will. Correct. From YU. There's the risk of living the rest of your life with only one kidney. So is that something which would preclude kidney donation? So if you look to the literature in the early part of the donation history, so in the 1960s and the 1970s, when, for example, Eliezer Waldenberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who just passed away this year, was writing about being a kidney donor, he said, based on the principles of David Ben Zimra, the risk of the donor could be quite great. Surgery was not perfected. There were fatalities associated with surgery. It was unknown if people could survive with one kidney and if there would be a higher likelihood of them developing a kidney disease themselves and requiring donation. So he said that it would be prohibited and that one would fall into this category of chassid shota, to serve as a kidney donor back in the 60s and early 70s, but not the case in 2007. Literature has borne out, and experience in the medical community has clearly borne out, that donation of a kidney is quite a safe procedure. Are there possibly fatalities? Yes, but they are exceedingly rare. The surgery can be done very safely. The surgery sometimes can be done laparoscopically. The risks have been minimized significantly. What about living your life with only one kidney? That also has been treated in the literature, and interestingly, and I'm sure there'll be more literature from the war in Iraq, but a lot of the literature comes from the military. So from the Korean War and the Vietnam War, you had these perfectly healthy soldiers that were going out into the battlefield. Many of them sustained gunshot wounds to the abdomen. They were otherwise healthy, but the in many cases, the shrapnel or the bullets perforated the kidney, and they had to have their kidneys removed. So we have the luxury of following thousands and thousands of these otherwise healthy people who had their kidneys removed on the battlefield to see if 10, 20, 30, 40 years down the line, they have a greater likelihood of developing kidney disease. And the medical community has found that while there is a small increased incidence of developing perhaps high blood pressure and kidney disease, it is relatively small. It is not a high percentage at all, not enough to preclude serving as a kidney donor from the eyes of halacha. So there isn't a single posek today that would forbid serving as a live kidney donor. And on your handout, just a reference from the Chavadas, Rav Avadya Yosef, it's obviously not the whole tshuva, but in that tshuva he says that one is very strongly encouraged to serve as a kidney donor. It's an extraordinary mitzvah. While he doesn't come right out and say you're mechuyev, you're obligated to do it, there is no question that it is a mitzvah of extraordinary magnitude. So how has this played out in the Jewish community? So you have in your handout, you have in the middle of the left hand of the first page, you have an ad which appeared in a journal called The Coalition, thanking a woman both her kidney donor and her surgeon, Dr. Stuart Greenstein, who actually is a chavrusa of mine at Montefiore Medical Center, for serving as a kidney donor. This appeared back in 2002. You have an experience that I have in my community. There was someone in the shul down the block from me who needed a kidney donation, and he put an index card, an anonymous index card, up on the bulletin board in shul asking for a kidney. And lo and behold, within the week, 8 people responded to the ad offering to be a donor to this individual. And as Hashkafa would have it, one of the individuals in the shul ended up serving as a successful kidney donor. And on the anniversary of the donation, the donor called for the recipient held a gala kiddush in honor of the donor. So there is this fascinating book on the bottom right hand. This is the front page of a book which I just happened upon accidentally, called Kleyot Yoatzos, which is just excerpted from the Talmud that the kidneys serve to give advice. But this entire sefer is devoted to the following shaila. There was an individual, and today is still a member of Knesset in Eretz Yisrael, who needed a kidney donation, and his doctor said that they would prefer him get a living donation. So he has 5 sons, Kanaidara. He came home from the doctor. He said, my doctor says I need a living donation. There was one son sitting in the living room. So the son immediately ran to Hadassah Hospital and got himself tested to be a kidney donor to his father. He returned back that evening, and sitting in the living room were his 4 brothers. And his 4 brothers said, what are you doing going to get tested? We want to be a kidney donor to our father. And the Bechor, the firstborn, said, you know, I not only have obligations here, I have rights. And my right is I get the schus to be a donor to my father. And they were fighting with each other. And he had 5 brothers, and there's no way in the world they could figure out how to decide this. So they went to one of the poskim in Eretz Yisrael, and they asked the shaila. And this entire sefer is devoted to that shaila. And what was the answer? Should I let you guys know the answer, or should I keep you in suspense for a little while? I'll tell you the answer at the end of this year. Rabbi Kelman, do you want to say that?
Based on Rav Moshe, I would say the first one. The way Rav Moshe writes, when you walk into a hospital, you have to do something. A doctor thinks there's too many people. He doesn't apply the mission of Arius. He says the first person you come across, you give it to. So I would think, off the top of my head, how luckily you give it to the first one who was sitting there. But he might have said the before, you know, in a traditional approach.
Let me answer now because I may forget. I may forget later. The Posek said that the first person who went to get himself tested may indeed have priority based on the principle, halachic principle of kol hamasel b'mitzvah omrim lo gemor. Anybody who begins the process of a mitzvah, we have an obligation to facilitate his completion of that mitzvah. So, but he also acknowledged that the bechor might have a right to serve as a kidney donor to his father. So he couldn't figure out which one of these two would be preferable. So he did a lottery between these two, between the bechor and between the first person who got himself tested, and the bechor is the one who literally won the lottery on this one, and he served as a successful donor to his father. I just saw a picture of his father, of the recipient, in the newspaper, clearly still involved in politics in any way. Baruch Hashem was a successful transplant. So to conclude our discussion of living organ donation, to return to our case, was it permitted for Mr. Patterson to serve as a kidney donor to his daughter? Now, clearly, it's mutter according to halacha for him to serve as a kidney donor to his daughter, Renata Patterson. Is he permitted to donate his second kidney and then go on dialysis? So there it's a more complicated shaila. Now, while this shaila hasn't been asked specifically to any poskim, I would be inclined to think that the risk to Mr. Patterson would be too great. He would likely fall into this category of chassid shota, as delineated by the rabbis. And in fact, no medical center accepted his request, and they all refused to allow him to serve as a donor of his second kidney. Now, what about these other issues of lung donation and liver donation? Where do they fare in this scheme? So they are relatively new, and perhaps liver donation, which has had some ups and downs over the years, might be where kidney donation was back in the 60s and early 70s, and maybe a little too risky to serve as a liver donor at this stage because the risk simply hasn't been quantified. So we'll have to see how that plays out. And like everything else, which we will mention again and again, the PSAC is based on the science of that day to see how things have evolved. It could be that liver donation will be abandoned because it's simply too risky. It could be that liver donation in 10, 20 years will be like kidney donation today and will be run-of-the-mill, and the risks will have been significantly minimized. Let us now turn our attention for a little bit to the issue of cadaveric donation. And I know, like I said, Mirzoshan, on Sunday, for those of you who have the schluss of attending, there'll be a nice conference. And I again encourage, if you have questions from that conference next week, for those of you who are able to attend, to clarify and address those. So the question, let me just address this question. Let me address both these questions before we go to cadaveric donation. First, Rabbi Kelman, what if the girl would die and he has a better chance on dialysis? I guess that would weigh into the consideration to some extent. If it really was a case of her death without the kidney transplant, the assumption is that she would go on dialysis and would be able to live on dialysis for a fair amount of time. And this gets to another question. You're allowed to donate for pikuach nefesh, but if these people with kidney problems have dialysis and they can live on dialysis for years, maybe you don't have a justification to donate your kidney to them. So the answer to that is, and Effie, I'll get to your question in a moment, the answer to that is, while it's true, it's not pikuach nefesh in the sense that someone with kidney disease will die like someone with heart failure who needs a heart transplant will die, but there are much greater complications for those on dialysis than those not on dialysis. It's a life-saving thing, but there's a higher incidence of strokes and infections and heart attacks, and it's definitely in the category of pikuach nefesh. Now, the question by Effie was, what about parts of the liver being donated? Yeah, that's really what I'm alluding to with live liver donation. And that is going on today. People can donate a lobe of their liver as a living human being to another living human being. it remains a risky procedure. In the New England Journal, there was just a review a few months ago, and there has been a fair amount of success, no question about it, but there have been some setbacks as well. And it's not so clear what the future holds with respect to liver donation. I have heard that Rav Elyashiv, at least in one case, did allow someone to serve as a liver donor, a live liver donor. But that fact is definitely not unanimous. So let's just spend some time on cadaveric donation. The issues with cadaveric donation, donating after death, are a whole set of different issues. Because we discussed with living donation, we discussed the obligation of an individual, lo samar adam reyefa, etc. When someone dies, we should all live to 120, mitzvah Hashem. There's no obligation of any mitzvahs, or chakshimina mitzvahs. So then what issues relate to cadaveric donation? Well, the issues relate to the obligations that devolve upon the body after death. So there's an obligation to bury the body, kavor tiparenu bayomahu. There's a prohibition to desecrate the body. There's a prohibition to derive benefit from the human body. All these are biblical obligations. The only way you can waive these obligations, and this we alluded to last week in our discussion of the Noda Behuda and anatomical dissection, is for the sake of pikuach nefesh. And as delineated by the Noda Behuda last week, it has to be pikuach nefesh for a chola lefanenu. Somebody will directly and immediately benefit from this violation of the prohibitions. So in organ donation, there clearly, as we said, there's 95,350 people on the United States' organ donation list. So there's always going to be somebody who will directly and immediately benefit from organ donation. So are you allowed to serve as an organ donor? Can you sign the back of your license to serve as an organ donor? So there's one other major factor which relates to cadaveric or deceased donation, which will invariably come up at the conference on Sunday, and that's the issue of the definition of cadaver, the definition of deceased. The organs come from the deceased, but we live in a funny world. There are two types of deceased. There's two types of cadavers. There's cadavers whose hearts are beating, and there's cadavers whose hearts are not beating. And this really is something crucial for all of us to understand in the world of organ donation, and allow me to explain for a few moments. If somebody would have lived 100 years ago and would have sustained, God forbid, a major heart attack, they would have had no blood flow to the brain, and their brain would have died within a few moments. And the converse is also true. If you sustained a massive bleed in the brain, or massive trauma to the brain, including the center of the brain, which controls the breathing, you would stop breathing, there'd be no oxygen to your heart, and your heart would stop beating all within a few moments. Not the case in 2007. For the first time in history over the past 56 years, there has been a dissociation of cardiac death and brain death. So now, if God forbid somebody sustains major head trauma, in the classic case is a motor vehicle accident or a motorcycle accident, where they sustain trauma to the entire brain, and normally, if nothing would be done, the person would be dead, and there would be no heartbeat, no brain function, but they are connected at the scene of the accident to a ventilator, to a respirator. What that respirator does is that respirator delivers oxygen artificially into the lungs and into the heart. So the heart can continue to beat with this artificially delivered oxygen, despite the fact that the brain has ceased to function. And this unique condition is called brain death. And not everybody who dies of brain death. Very small percentage of people who die of this brain death. It's a unique medical condition. But it's one which has been defined by modern medicine over the last, starting in the late 60s. And it is these patients who are in this category of brain death. They are the ones that serve as the donors for 90% of the organs that come from cadavers. So the major halachic question is, are these individuals from whom the organs are harvested, are they considered legally dead in the eyes of Jewish law or not? Because while it's true that one is allowed to violate prohibitions for the sake of pikuach nefesh. And all these most prohibitions can be violated. One prohibition that cannot be violated is resicha, is murder. And if an individual who's brain dead is not legally dead in the eyes of Jewish law, then one can't harvest their organ. So that is the crux of a major debate in the 20th and 21st century. It remains one of the greatest debates in rabbinic history. There is no consensus whatsoever. There are great rabbis who acknowledge, accept brain death as legal halakhic death, and would allow those to serve as an organ donor, because it is indeed pikuach nefesh for the recipients. And there are great poskim who reject brain death, and not because they don't want to advance science, not because they don't want to save human lives, but because they genuinely believe that the individual is still halakhically alive, and they would not allow an individual to serve as an organ donor, because in that brain death situation, a person would not be considered halakhically alive. So just for the last remaining few minutes, I'll share with you some sources which are marshaled in this discussion. I just mentioned that it will turn to the two pages, deceased organ donation in Jewish law. Obviously, we just have a few minutes left. We're not going to read everything inside, but just a few references and things you should be familiar with. The first reference in the Torah to organ donation is from Yechezkel, where it says, "V'nasati lachem leiv chadash v'ruach chadasha etein bekirvachem, v'hasi rosi es leiv ha'evan mibsarchem." I will remove the heart which has high cholesterol and cholesterol plaques. "V'nasati lachem leiv vasar," and I'll give you a new heart for transplant. Clearly a foreshadowing and allusion to modern-day transplantation. So what possible sources could the poskim today in the 20th and 21st century use to determine whether brain death is considered halachic death or not? So there are a few sources, and we're just going to mention them briefly. One is the Mishnah in Olos, and the Mishnah discusses issues of Tumah v'Tahara, what generates impurity, what doesn't generate impurity, and it says the Mishnah begins, "Adam eino metame ad shetetzei nafsho." One, it doesn't generate impurity for a kohen; the corpse generates impurity until the soul is departed the body. And skipping to the second line, towards the end, "Hutzu roshehen, afal pishim efarkasin, tamein." So the Mishnah says that for animals and human beings, according to most Meforshim, if they are completely decapitated, even though there is subsequent bodily movement, so the arms can move, the legs can move, but if the head has been decapitated, that person is dead. So there are those who have analogized this to brain death and called brain death physiological decapitation. What does physiological decapitation mean? It means that while the head may be technically physically connected to the body, there is no connection between the brain and the rest of the body. The command center is defunct. There are no signals from the brain to the rest of the body. While it's true the heart is beating, it is true that you will have a pulse, it is true that you will have a blood pressure, these are all just simply manifestations of artificially delivered things to a corpse. That is one position invoking the Mishnah in Olos. The other few sugyas which have been invoked include the Gemara in Yoma. The Gemara in Yoma is a classic case, again reminiscent of things which we see all too frequently in our current days, of a building that's collapsed, and there are people buried under the rubble. And the context is it happens to be on a Shabbos. And you're allowed for pikuach nefesh to do anything to save the life of another human being. You're allowed to violate Shabbos clearly, but the minute you know that this individual is not alive, you no longer have a license to violate Shabbos. So the Gemara details a circumstance where you're uncovering the rubble and you reach certain parts of the body, whether you're uncovering from the feet first or the head first, at what section of the body that you uncover that you can examine, can you determine with certainty that the individual is dead? So it's a machlokes. Some say you uncover the nostrils and you put a feather or a mirror and you see if the individual has any respirations. Some say you uncover the chest wall to see if the heart is to see if the heart is beating. And we paskin that it's the nostrils which determines. And one aspect, and I apologize, this is a very complex sugya, one we could spend many, many hours. It's interesting, halachically and sociologically interesting, that those who accept brain death and those who reject brain death all use the same exact halachic sources, but they come to diametrically opposed conclusions from the same sources. It's quite a fascinating study in mechanics of halacha. But this source, Megamar Yoma, is one of those classic sources which is used. And just to turn to the last page. Just to turn to the last page of our handout, to give you the precursor to the 20th and 21st century debate about brain death as we close for the last few minutes of today's lecture, one of the classic sources is the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer wrote in the 1800s. So the question is, 1700s, late 1700s, early 1800s. Why is the Chassam Sofer being invoked about the definition of death? So the answer is, if you turn to the last page of your handout, for following curious reason, back in the 1700s, an individual named Jacques Benin Winslow, and it's close to the top of your handout, wrote a book called The Uncertainty of the Signs of Death. And that book was written in Latin and would have been relegated to obscurity. No one ever would have read it or cared about it had it not been translated into English and by another individual whose name was Jacques Brier. And he translated it into English, translated into French, and he basically single-handedly scared an entire generation into the belief that people were being buried prematurely, that death was not being properly diagnosed, that you should fear that if doctors say that you're dead, you're really not dead. And this literally scared an entire generation throughout Europe. There's plenty of literature. Edgar Allan Poe wrote the book The Premature Burial. There's a wonderful book today on this history called Buried Alive for anybody who's interested. But to such an extent that a number of communities in Europe legislated that anybody who died in their domain couldn't be buried immediately. They had to be kept above ground for 3 days until rigor mortis and the gangrene set in. And then and only then would you know with certainty that the individual had died. So this generated a widespread halachic concern, because halacha is you have to bury immediately. Kavorti perenu vayom hahu. So how can you circumvent the law, the obligation to bury, to wait for 3 days? So it stimulated the entire rabbinic community of that period, the 1700s and 1800s, to analyze the sugyas that determined death, to see how death was defined. And this was just as widespread amongst the just as intense a debate as the current brain death debate. It was the precursor to our current debate. And in the upper left hand corner, you have those who capitalized, the entrepreneurs who capitalized on the premature burial concern, and you have somebody there who's interred 6 feet under, but he's hooked up to a pulley system from his fingers and toes, which is then in turn hooked up to a bell on a tower, that if the individual should wake up after he's buried and move his head or his fingers or his toes, it would ring a bell that those outside could hear. Hence the term, saved by the bell. This is the origin of, some say it's from boxing, some say it's from this, it's a historical debate, but hence the term saved by the bell. And just to conclude, as we bring this up into the 21st century, as I mentioned, it remains a major debate amongst the rabbinic authorities, with many people accepting brain death and allowing and encouraging organ donation, and many people rejecting brain death. But just one important clarification. There has been a lot of misunderstanding about what brain death is, and some of you may have heard of the classic Terry Schiavo case of a woman who tragically was in a persistent vegetative state after a cardiac arrest in her 20s, I believe, who was being preserved on a feeding tube. She was comatose, not able to interact with her environment, and there was a debate about whether her feeding tube should be removed or not. And you have in the bottom right-hand corner, you have actually the picture of her tombstone. Very, very interesting epitaph. It says, Shaivo, etc., born December 1963, departed this earth February 1990, which is the day that she had her cardiac arrest and the day that she went into a persistent vegetative state, at peace March 31st, 2005. That was obviously written by her husband. It wasn't written by her parents, for those of you who followed the debate. Be that as it may, I'll get to that question in a second, Rick Hellman. Terry Schiavo was not brain dead. Terry Schiavo had a persistent vegetative state. While the cortex of her brain, the large part of her brain, was not functioning, the brain stem, which controls the vegetative functions, hence the name persistent vegetative state, was completely intact. She was not hooked up to any respirator at all. She was breathing spontaneously on her own. She had no terminal condition. There was no way, no reason she couldn't have lived many, many more years after that. And just to also to hasten to add, those just a question to you. For those who have been diagnosed with the neurologically correct diagnosis of brain death, what percentage of them, or how many of them that have ever been diagnosed with brain death have ever woken up and walked out of the hospital? I don't know if any of you want to hazard a guess. The answer, 0.0 cases in the Star and the Inquirer notwithstanding. There has never been a recorded case of a properly diagnosed brain dead patient that has ever regained any function whatsoever. This brain death is the inexorable a pathway to cardiac death. Now, cardiac death may not ensue for a while, and the scientists still don't understand that, and it is an issue of great complexity, but there is no question that it is the process of death is in some way, shape, or form begun. Just to, so what about the case today of a woman who woke up after 6 years and asked for a piece of cake? I didn't read about that. I'd love to get a copy of that to add it to the list. There's literally a handful of these cases every single year. None of these cases are brain dead cases. They are all patients who are comatose, in varying levels of coma. To give you an idea of the complexity of coma, coma is a spectrum. The book on coma, the classic textbook on coma, is about a foot thick. It is not a simple diagnosis. This woman was clearly not brain dead. She was in a comatose state. And just to get to Rabbi Kelman's question, what was the Chassam Sofer's view on brain death? As I mentioned about the other sources, there are those, both camps, those who support and who reject brain death, will both cite the Chassam Sofer in support of their opinion. We don't have time now to go through a textual analysis, but there's certain phrases in the Chassam Sofer which allude one way, certain phrases which allude another way. The bottom line is, in my view, it's very difficult to make certain extrapolations. The question you really have to ask is not what the Chassam Sofer said back in the 1800s. The question you always have to ask is, if the Chassam Sofer were writing today, what would the answer be to the question of the determination of death? He could have anticipated this current debate. So some of it is a bit of extrapolation. So that concludes our current session. I'm happy to entertain any questions. And just to remind you, if you have questions from the session on Sunday, I'd be delighted to keep those in mind, write those down. I'm sure you'll get 99.9% of them answered, but if there are any clarifications, I'm happy to pick that up next week. Next week, I believe we will be doing genetics and the human genome project. Will it be Elon?
It'll be Elon or Elon. You spell it with an E, but we spell it with an I.
Right.
Okay. So for those who don't know, Eddie has a daughter, Ilana, with an E, and of course I have a wife, Ilana, with an I. So we'll have the debate next week. Like we did last week, you know, now that if anybody has to go, they can go, I'm sure. But Eddie, if you want to like try out to see if you can speak instead of writing in, and all you have to do is hit the transmit button on the upper left-hand corner, hold it down and speak, and for those who have to leave, we'll push you with a chalice of a seal. But we'll take a few minutes of questions, and we'll let Eddie go, even if you have more questions. We'll have to keep it for next
question. Yes?
When you use the word brain death and your physiological decapitation, the brain stem, the Psakovra of Tendler, when you use that term in the past hour, do the doctors in the New York hospitals, are they consistent with that definition of Rabbi Tendler's brain death? Or, as in the past, we've had Harvard criteria of brain death, which is certainly a far cry from physiological decapitation. What's loosely going on the wards, in the hospitals, in the perception of the doctors in New York?
That's an excellent question. And the question is, there are criteria for brain death. Practically in the hospital, how are these criteria applied? Are they abused? Are they misapplied? Is there consistency within the medical community? And the answer to that is there is no uniform criteria which is obligatory or legally required in the United States for the determination of brain death. So one hospital might require imaging studies. One hospital might require just bedside diagnosis. One hospital might require interval or repetition of the brain death diagnosis at 24 hours. One might require it at 6 hours or 12 hours. So you are indeed correct in addressing that issue. However, if there is a case of a person who has a halachic sensitivity who wishes to serve as an organ donor, you can require that the diagnosis be confirmed in the way that you want it confirmed. So the case is, I'm clearly not a POSIC, and I can't overemphasize that. In the cases that I've been involved in, I've, in certain cases, recommended further imaging studies, recommended perhaps waiting to reconfirm the diagnosis. You can call your own neurologist in to reconfirm the diagnosis. So while it is true there is no uniformity, if the diagnosis is established correctly, it is clearly a diagnosis which hasn't changed since its inception with the Harvard criteria back in the late 60s. But your point is definitely well taken. So I'm just reading a question here on the bottom. Will Halacha have to address the question of means? How much is the obligation for children to keep comatose parents alive if there is no insurance? Is there some way of measuring the needs of the young against the needs of the dying? Very, very difficult question. How do finances figure into to this issue? And we actually alluded to it to some extent at the beginning of our discussion with Lo Sa'amod al Dam Re'echa. We didn't address that dimension, but there is a halachic discussion about how far your obligation extends financially. We said there is a financial obligation, but how far is that financial obligation of Lo Sa'amod al Dam Re'echa? Is it 20%? And the answer to that, by the way, is an extensive halachic debate having to do whether the obligation is framed as a lav, as a negative prohibition or a positive prohibition. Are you obligated to expend 20% of your finances, 100% of your finances? But it's not a simply answered question. And I know, working in the hospital with patients at the end of life, many individuals, you're addressing the concern of the family members, many patients don't want to be kept alive because they don't want the entire fortune that they've spent their life accumulating They don't want to see it dissipate in a matter of months in an intensive care unit. They spent their whole lives accumulating money so that their family would have the means after they die, and then that money can be gone virtually in a week or two in the intensive care unit. So it's a factor in the individual patient's decision about whether they want life-prolonging therapy or not wanting life-prolonging therapy. So there's no easy answer to that question. But I will say that, in general, finances don't play as much of a factor in the halachic decision-making process. There may be a communal obligation to help assist in that funding. It may be part of the communal tzedakah, perhaps. That's something which would merit further discussion as well.
All right. Maybe anybody? Oh, one last question. Otherwise, we'll let Daddy get ready for Shabbos or sign-off and raise.
No, Effie's correcting my terminology. Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I will use these interchangeably, especially in these kinds of lectures. I'll use the ventilator, respirator, life support system. So your point is well taken, Effie. You are obviously correct in the strict interpretation of the technical. Yeah, we don't ECMO is used not so frequently by us, but colloquially, obviously, we interchange the terms ventilator and respirator.
All right, thank you. Have a good night. Good Shabbos, everybody.
Have a good Shabbos, everybody. And we'll see you next week. And for those of you who can attend the conference, I'm actually, for those who are going to be at the Walensky Lecture, we'll see you there. Mitzvah Shem on Sunday.